being poor is a growth industry in America.
More than 15% of Americans below the poverty line in 2009.
The young ones are hungry, their nests are so bare. All it takes is...
This administration today, here and now, declares unconditional war on poverty in America.
Concern for the poor inspires all kinds of sentimental hand-wringing and expensive government programs. Lyndon Johnson declared war on poverty back in 1964.
Nearly 40 years and billions of dollars later, who's surrendered?
The U.S. economy and the poor, singing a different tune in 2010.
We're looking for a silver lining. It's The Takeaway.
All across America, this is The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Celeste Headlee from Public Radio International and WNYC.
Good morning, everyone. It's Friday, September 17th. The poor, a growth industry in the United States.
And that's actually right at the top of the news today. New figures have put a real number on Americans affected by the recession. 43.5 million people now live below the poverty line. The Census Bureau says that's one in seven people and one in five children in the U.S.
Joining us now from Washington is Ron Haskins, Senior Fellow of Economic Studies and Co-Director of the Center on Children and Families at the Brookings Institution. Good morning, Ron.
Good morning.
So, Ron, as a policy person who studies this sort of thing, how do you see this poverty threshold? Is it an arbitrary number, kind of a line, or more like the surface of the water? You really feel it when you sink below it.
It's a line, that's for sure, and it's established by the political process. There's no scientific way to do it. The logic of it way back in the 60s when it was established is that it's three times what it cost for an adequate diet, because at that time Americans spent three times what they spent on food to live. So it had a basis, but it's established by the political process, and it could be changed by the political process.
Political moving target, the poverty line. We're going to talk about it with Ron Haskins. Stay with us. We'll be back with you in a moment. Two major hurricanes now. Hurricane Carl expected to make landfall in southern Mexico as a Category 3 storm later today, and Bermuda is bracing for Hurricane Igor this weekend. Igor remains a monster Category 4 storm and is not expected to weaken.
More violence in Afghanistan ahead of tomorrow's parliamentary elections. Two more election workers were killed this morning by Taliban fighters in northern Afghanistan. The Taliban says violence will continue, and they've threatened all those who take part in the election. However, Defense Secretary Robert Gates thinks the security plan should hold up.
The Afghans have a capable and competent security plan for the elections. We will provide support as needed.
The death toll for campaign staff and election workers in the run-up to tomorrow's vote now stands at 21. Days of difficult peace negotiations between the Israelis and the Palestinians have ended for now. Palestinians have threatened to leave the talks if Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu does not extend a partial moratorium on the construction of settlements. That's something he's refused to do. Secretary of State Hillary Clinton attended the talks. She says if an agreement is to be reached, the pieces are in place.
I am convinced that this is the time and these are the leaders who can achieve the result we all seek.
Palestinian President Mahmoud Abbas says he sees no alternative but to keep talking.
Five men have been arrested by British police as the Pope, Benedict XVI, continues his first official trip to the United Kingdom. Right now, he's in London. He was speaking at an outdoor mass earlier today. Asian markets are mixed. European indices are up. Futures are up. The Dow gets underway at 10,594. The S&P starts at 1,124. And the Nasdaq opens at 2305. We're going to re-examine this idea of who's rich and who's poor in the nation. We got the conversation started with you. Give us a call. What are the markers in your life that indicate you're in one or the other category? Reach us at 877-8-MY-TAKE.
And stay with us. Later this hour, we're going to be talking to Philip Seymour Hoffman about his new movie and his directorial debut. The film's called Jack Goes Boating. But in the meantime, we're going to focus on these new census numbers that show we're approaching the poverty levels we first declared in the 1960s, more than 50 years ago.
Good morning, everyone. We talked about this yesterday. We were anticipating these numbers.
I think we're going to end up talking about it a lot more in the future also.
Well, here's a straightforward news story on The Takeaway. The new census data for 2009 was released yesterday. It shows that U.S. poverty rates have hit a 15-year high and are approaching 1960s levels. 15% people below the poverty line in the United States when President Lyndon Johnson spoke these words.
And this administration today, here and now, declares unconditional war on poverty in America.
Again, that was back in 1964. Well, the war on poverty continued. Either we've surrendered or something significantly different is happening in the economy for that rise in poverty to be reported yesterday by the census numbers. We want to have a kind of a different discussion on what the war on poverty and the threshold of the poverty line actually means in the United States. Ron Haskins joins us. He's a senior fellow of economic studies and co-director of the Center on Children and Families at the Brookings Institution. Good morning again, Ron.
Good morning.
And we bring in our friend and expert on development issues around the world, Jacqueline Novogratz, who's the founder and CEO of the Acumen Fund. Her book, The Blue Sweater, Bridging the Gap Between Rich and Poor in an Interconnected World, tells a story of how it's not so much the poverty line that matters, it's the relationship between the people at the bottom of the economic ladder and the top of the economic ladder. Jacqueline, is that about right?
That's right. Nice to hear you, John.
It's great to talk to you this morning. First, Ron, let's get more into this idea of the poverty line as a political marker. The political system sets where the poverty line is. It may or may not be based in economic reality. What do these numbers that came out yesterday tell us as a snapshot of the U.S. economy right now?
They tell us that a lot more people are unemployed, and they tell us that there's a lot more misery. And the most important part, you didn't mention this, but poverty is also up quite substantially among children, which is my greatest concern. So there's more misery generated primarily because there's less employment.
How frustrating is it to you that, as you say, this is a moving target? The political forces can sort of place this marker wherever they want. They can make the picture look better or worse, depending upon what it is they want to accomplish.
Right. Well, the political process has never changed the poverty level, except it's adjusted each year by inflation. But there is a lot of discussion. There's been a tremendous amount of work, especially since a report from the National Academy of Science in 1995. I think there's widespread agreement that our poverty level, the way we measure poverty in the United States, makes absolutely no sense. Some people even say it's the worst federal statistic because it just does not reflect reality. Not just because it's family of four on $22,000 or $23,000 a year, but because the way the actual level is calculated, way people's income is calculated is flawed. Because lots of income is not counted.
Right.
So there are serious flaws in the measure. The administration would very much like to change it, and they will present a new measure. It'll be an experimental measure, but it will be presented next year at this time.
And that could change the number again, but again, it will be a statistical change. Ron Haskins from the Brookings Institution. Jacqueline Novogratz, the relationship between people at the bottom of the income ladder and the top, how has that manifested itself as the real marker of the significance of poverty in the places you visited around the world?
Acumen works in Pakistan, India, and East Africa, where the gap between rich and poor is enormous and in some of the countries widening. And the manifestation is, I think, really about dignity and the sense of, if I'm so far behind and people are moving further ahead, it doesn't really matter if my absolute level of wealth is getting a little bit better. If I feel even further behind than others, there's a sense of being left out of the system. There's a sense of not having access to choice. And that is where I think you start to get major rifts in populations. You see, unfortunately, what we're starting to see in the United States. Much more investment by the rich on security and building their own private systems, and that's where you have society breakdown.
Interesting. I want to talk about the United States in a moment. Can you give an example of where the absolute number of poverty is actually terrifying to an American, but because there is this sense that we're all in it together, a more communal sense in the nation, it ameliorates the idea of poverty and people feel less poor?
You know, I do a lot of work in the Kibera slums outside of Nairobi, and it's really interesting in that a whole group of slum dwellers read my book, 100 of them. And the whole book is about poverty in Rwanda and genocide, and the way they read it was not about themselves. They saw my stories of failure in it. They wanted to be part of solving the gap between rich and poor themselves. Mm. They talked about people who are less well off than they are. They want to be seen. They want to be visible. And they want to be working on solutions to bring themselves better sanitation, better health care, and are doing so. I think the issue for low-income communities like that is often wanting to be connected to the larger economy, finding those opportunities, but a real willingness to be seen and being part of it.
Ron, the definition of poor kind of cuts both ways. I mean, I know the $22,000 for a family of four is an incredibly small amount of money. And often that political line is drawn because that's where people start getting social services. People will move that line down in order to keep costs down. And therefore, I imagine there's a whole lot of people who feel like they're not cutting it, like they are below the poverty line, but they don't qualify.
Well, actually, the poverty line does figure in some eligibility for some programs, but we have a vast array of programs, and some are based on a poverty line and some not. There are an income tax credit, which is a $50 billion program. All the money goes to families who are low income, but many of the families are well above the poverty level. It goes all the way up to almost $40,000. And there are other programs like that as well. So we have a lot of people who are well above poverty who still get benefits.
Well, Eugenia, listen to this, Ron and Jacqueline. When I started getting phone calls from creditors for the first time in my life, one thing that would make me feel rich was eating a tablespoon or two of sour cream. Now I feel poor because I'm still homeless after my foreclosure. I also have two infected teeth I can't do anything about. I want to save my teeth, and I can't. That's her definition of poverty. Jacqueline Novogratz, do you think there's development work to do here in the United States if you were to parachute in?
I think there's extraordinary development work to be done and huge opportunity, John. What we're seeing in social innovation here could be connected to bringing greater dignity
right.
And I think there are social entrepreneurs like what we're seeing in education with Michelle Rhee in D.C. and new schools that are trying to really think about our kids with more investment strategies, even when you look at food.
Way beyond the numbers. Thinking about poverty not as a line, but as a set of relationships. Jacqueline Novogratz, founder and CEO of the Acumen Fund. Ron Haskins at Brookings. Thanks to you both. And at 15 minutes after the hour, let's check in on some headlines we're following.
Sarah Palin travels to Iowa today. The former Republican vice presidential candidate will be raising money for her party and at the same time raising speculation about a possible 2012 bid for the White House. She'll be in Des Moines. Earlier, House Minority Whip Eric Cantor spoke about it on The Takeaway.
If you look at Sarah Palin, she's a working mom. She's testament to the fact that in America, not only can you have everything, you can do everything. You know, and so this villainization of Sarah Palin really has no place in the discourse.
Palin was last in Iowa in December as part of her book tour. Shareholders of Continental Airlines and United Airlines vote on a $3 billion deal between the two companies today. If approved, the merger will create the world's biggest airline.
22 people are dead in Mexico after a gun battle between soldiers and suspected drug cartel members. Officials say the fighting broke out 18 miles south of the Texas border when gang members opened fire on patrolling soldiers. Just weeks after Fox News anchor Glenn Beck's Restoring Honor rally drew 100,000 demonstrators to the Washington Mall, two Comedy Central hosts have announced rallies of their own. Jon Stewart announced his Million Moderate March on The Daily Show last night, and Stephen Colbert followed up with his announcement.
I am calling for the nation to join me on the Washington Mall for the March to Keep Fear Alive.
Both rallies will take place on October 30th. Cable television has taken over the Washington Mall. That's a look at some of the stories we're watching this morning. Later this hour, we'll get your weekend started by talking about the new film Jack Goes Boating with the two stars, Philip Seymour Hoffman, who also directed, and Amy Ryan. That's in a half hour.
I give that film two thumbs up.
Two thumbs up?
Yeah. Well, yesterday, while we were all focusing on other things, the Senate passed a bill that's aimed at helping small businesses. It had been actually languishing in Congress for a very long time. But lawmakers claim that the legislation includes billions in aid and incentives for small business owners, and it's expected to pass the House next week. Joining us right now, we have Todd Zwillick, our Washington correspondent. Good morning, Todd.
Hi, good morning, Celeste.
And also Walt Rowan, owner of Susquehanna Glass Company in Columbia, Pennsylvania. Good morning.
Good morning, Celeste.
How closely were you watching this legislation, if at all?
I was aware of it in the background, but you know, quite truthfully, things are not getting through Congress very quickly, so I was a little surprised.
Well, Todd Zwillick, how about everybody else? Were people in Washington surprised that it finally passed?
Well, people got surprised in August when one of the Republicans who had been helping to filibuster this bill for months and months and months finally said, enough is enough, I'm going to break ranks. It was George Voinovich, Republican of Ohio, which is a state that certainly has a lot of small and large businesses that are hurting. He said he was going to finally vote to break the filibuster, and he did, and the bill was able to pass. Interesting thing about George Voinovich, he's retiring. He's not running for re-election, so breaking ranks and joining the Democrats doesn't hurt him, maybe like other Republicans think that it might.
Okay, so Walt Rowan, you would call yourself a small businessman, right?
Yes, we employ about 35 people.
Okay, so Walt, take a listen. Todd's going to explain what's in this bill. You can hear, listen for if there's anything in there that affects Susquehanna Glass in Columbia, okay?
Okay.
Okay, so Todd, tell Walt what is in this bill.
Okay, right. Well, the first problem that we have in the economy, the big problem for small businesses, I imagine maybe like Walt, tight credit. Even credit-worthy businesses can't get credit. This bill frees up about $30 billion in federal loan guarantees filtered through community banks to make credit easier. Second, you've got about $12 billion in tax cuts. Businesses can get new tax incentives for hiring. Also, they can get what's called accelerated depreciation. Now, that's a fancy word for, you know, when you buy equipment, let's say at Susquehanna Glassworks, you buy a furnace. Over 7-8 years, it degrades. It depreciates the value of it. It stops working. Businesses can write off those costs eventually when equipment depreciates. This bill lets you write it off right away. You get all the tax breaks right up front if you buy this year, and that's an incentive to invest in new equipment. And it also increases to $500,000 the amount of investment spending that they can write off right away. And the whole point is spend this year, businesses, expand this year, buy new equipment this year, and hire this year, and we'll make it worth your while in the tax code.
Okay, Walt, anything there to get you excited?
Well, first of all, we've been lucky that our local bank has been very supportive. So we don't need personally. We're fine on credit, although I've heard a number of discussions about it. A lot of small businesses have had that problem. So if I were in a situation where my small bank wasn't supporting me, that would be very, very helpful for me.
What's the name of your bank, Walt? I want to call them up.
we've been using M&T Bank, and they've been really good.
But what about the rest of it? How about those tax credits and the incentives to hire people?
I'm not sure how the hiring incentive is going to work. I don't know how it would actually function, but the accelerated depreciation is definitely something that a small business guy would be, we would take advantage of. However, I do want to say the problem is that as a small business, we're not going to go out and buy a piece of equipment just because there's a tax policy that's going to make it a little bit more advantageous right now.
You need to have actually work on the books to do that, right?
Well, yeah, the problem is that when I look at what I'm going to be doing and make decisions, it's going to be based on what the economic outlook is. If there's demand for my product, I hire more people and I buy more equipment. So if the overall economic outlook is still really slow, even if I can get a credit on buying a piece of equipment, I'm not going to buy the equipment if I don't think I need it.
Well, Todd, do you have more details on how the hiring incentive works?
There's a certain amount of money that you get, you can write off of your business expenses for hiring. And Celeste, I don't know exactly how much it is for each person, because I'm not sure if it was defined in the statute or not.
Well, we should have Walt hire us. Walt will hire us and we'll find out. Walt, what piece of equipment do you just covet? And give me like the most technical name for it. I mean, you're a glass company, right?
Yeah, I'm a glass decorating company, so something like a laser engraver is something that we
How
much does that cost?
What do they run?
And it would cost us probably about $25,000 to buy a piece of equipment like that. So if we had been waiting and we really wanted to buy that equipment, that this tax policy would definitely push us over into doing it now. There's
it
no
would.
Question about it.
Okay, and Todd, how much is this bill expected to cost the government?
It's about $50 billion total, $30 billion in tax credits, $30 billion in the loan guarantees, $12 billion in tax credits. Then there's other sort of odds and ends, and there comes to around 50.
That's a lot of laser engravers there.
That is. So, Walt, is there something that you would have rather seen? Is there something missing out of this bill that actually would have made you hire somebody?
I think they're on the right track. The problem is that there's a pervading sentiment that Obama is anti-business. business, and I don't see that. I think his policies have been very supportive of business, and I think that this is just another example that he's on the right track. What has to happen is that the public has to begin to have more confidence that we're going in the right direction.
All right. Well,
and
everybody
I think
heard it.
Things that need to happen.
Y'all need to buy some glass from Walt Rowan
Please.
At Susquehanna Glass Company
Please.
In Columbia, Pennsylvania, so he can hire some people. Todd Zwillick, did the debate over the extension of the Bush tax cuts enter into this debate?
Oh, it always does, because one of the arguments against letting tax cuts for $250,000 and over expire is that a lot of small businesses make over $250,000, and you're going to stifle hiring and stifle small business. So that's one of the main Republican arguments. Don't let the have to extend those tax cuts or small businesses suffer. They're going to be fighting about that for the next 2 weeks.
Okay, Todd Zwillick is our Washington correspondent and Walt Rowan owner of Susquehanna Glass Company in Columbia, Pennsylvania. Thanks to both of you. You can get more of Todd's political coverage on Washington. Just head over to our site and you can track his tweets. That's at thetakeaway.org.
You know, that construction guy we talked to a couple weeks ago said the same thing.
It's pretty much
I'm
the same
gonna
thing.
I'm not going to hire or buy new equipment unless I have orders.
And he said the legislation's kind of on the right track, too.
Right.
Have you ever skipped an election day, voting on election day because it was raining? Well, in Afghanistan, people vote despite death threats. We're going to talk about tomorrow's parliamentary elections there in just a moment. First, here's some of the news stories we're following at 30 minutes after the hour. Category 3 Hurricane Carl is now less than 100 miles from the coast of Mexico. Carl is one of three hurricanes turning in the Atlantic Basin. Another is Hurricane Igor, which is expected to impact Bermuda over the weekend. And much, much further out to sea, we have Hurricane Julia that's making a move west. The Senate Foreign Relations Committee has approved a new nuclear arms reduction treaty with Russia. The treaty will reduce the U.S. and Russia's strategic nuclear weapons by 30%. It now heads to a vote in the full Senate, where it needs two-thirds support.
The impeachment trial of a Louisiana federal judge continues today. Judge Gabriel Portis is facing allegations of accepting bribes of cash, alcohol, and a Las Vegas bachelor party for his son. The first impeachment trial by the Senate since President Clinton's in 1999, and the first for a member of the judiciary since 1989. And in soap news, yeah, my mother's going to freak out about this. As the World Turns airs one last time today as the soap opera ends its long-time run. Yep, that's right. Show made its debut when television was relatively new to American households back in 1956. When I was born, yes, indeed. Let's check the markets. Asian and European markets are mixed. Futures are up on Wall Street. The Dow starts at 10,594. S&P at 1,124. The Nasdaq 2,305. Those are some of the headlines we're following this morning.
Voters in Afghanistan go to the polls tomorrow to vote in parliamentary elections. And this time, despite death threats and intimidation, there's actually a record number of women contesting seats. But there are still real concerns, not just for voters, but also for the people running for office. News just this morning that two election workers were killed in Afghanistan by the Taliban. And we also got this comment from one Afghan woman who is running for office.
Yes, I've been threatened. Every night I put up my posters, but the next morning I find they've gone. Every day people come and tell me they've heard I've been killed or injured. I'm focusing on campaigning in the city center as I can't travel to the district.
Quentin Somerville, BBC correspondent in Kabul, spoke with us earlier this morning about how women are shaping this election. But first, we spoke with Shukira Barakzai. She's running for re-election in Afghanistan as an MP, and said having heard stories of death threats and election workers killed in her country, Shukria described her concerns about running for office.
I understand. I'm one of the Afghans among millions of Afghans. That the situation in Afghanistan is not in a very normal way that people can stand very freely without any threat. I'm sure all candidates can understand which kind of challenges they are facing today for running and tomorrow being an MP. I was one of them that since 7 years or maybe nearby 8 years, I received many times death threats starting from the car bomb till everything. But this is the country, and the situation is not really normal way. So we have to accept such a kind of things, and we have to be prepared, and we have to be understand the challenges as well. It doesn't matter that there's a death threat or not. We have to promote, provide, and support democracy for Afghanistan, and we have to stand for those values which is we believe. This is important for us right now to have a new parliament and again to practicing the exercise of democracy. To institutionalizing democracy, it's always needs sacrifice, sacrifice of the nation. And I'm sure women is not the only group which is today their target. In Afghanistan, everybody's a target.
Right.
Religious people, ordinary people, women's groups and women's rights activists.
Shukriya Barakzai is actually running for re-election as an MP in Afghanistan in Kabul. Also with us is Quentin Somerville. You just heard Shukriya speaking, and you've actually focused specifically about how women could shape this election. Can you talk to me about how that actually will play out? There are seats set aside for women, and is that changing the discussion?
That's right. There's an allotted amount, at least 64 seats set aside for women in the parliament. There are almost 300 seats in the parliament in total. Is that really changing and improving women's rights in Afghanistan? The answer is maybe, perhaps. It's certainly giving women more prominence. But even despite that, the fact that there were so many women MPs in the last parliament, a good number of them still supported a law which harmed the women, the human rights of Shia women. It meant that Shia men were able to have sex with their wives, whether their wives wanted to or not, and it also meant that Shia men could decide when or if their daughters or wives went to school. That was approved by female MPs. Of course, though, let's remember, back in the Taliban times, women weren't allowed to be educated, they weren't allowed to work. That has changed significantly. There has been an improvement in women's rights, but having an allotted number of women MPs doesn't necessarily mean you're going to guarantee the human rights of women in particular.
Well, we're hearing some very disturbing things coming out of Afghanistan. I mentioned the report this morning that two election workers were killed there. There's also the Taliban claiming to have abducted 18 election officials and campaign workers. Do you think things are more dangerous right now than they were during the last election?
As you heard from Shukriya there, Afghanistan is a very dangerous place. And whether you're a woman MP, whether you're a male MP, or whether you're an ordinary individual going about your business, life is very risky here. In fact, 24 people have been killed in election-related violence, but at least 50 people die here every single day as a result of the insurgency and the counterinsurgency. Is the security situation worse than the last election back in 2003? Absolutely, without a shadow of a doubt, it is. And it's the thing that most Afghans care about is their security. It's the number one issue for them. President Karzai has said he will guarantee security. There's 300,000 foreign and local security forces will be out in force in tomorrow's election. But the Taliban are making good on their promise to disrupt it. As you said, 18 people kidnapped in the west of the country. And we've also heard this morning that a candidate in the east of the country has been kidnapped by the Taliban.
Shukriya, you have three children?
Three daughters.
Okay, and actually in 1999, you were beaten by Taliban religious police when you were caught on the street without your husband.
Yes.
Is that part of what motivates you to risk your life to run for parliament?
It's not hard for me. I have a goal and vision for my country. And I'm also one of the mothers, which is I'm sitting with those people every day in the parliament and working about the law and reform and making Afghanistan to giving a new picture for Afghanistan. But those people, which is they killed my two child, because of them I lost my two children during the civil war in Afghanistan. But it doesn't matter that this kind of threat and this kind of memories will disturbing me. It always gives me the idea that we have to work, at least not only for the other mothers, but for the children, for the next generation, which is we have to sacrifice our life for their better future. I understand how dangerous these things and how difficult it is when we are talking by that way. But in the meantime, there's a lot of progress which has happened in Afghan women's lives since 9 years. And particularly past 5 years was the years that Afghan community and Afghan society heard women and they saw women as a political leaders in the parliament. And they also today they are respecting and they are supporting more women than men. Although men, they have a gun, they have a power, they have a money, they can abuse their own legal and legitimate power. But women, we don't have anything like that to abuse it or even sometimes to use it on a positive way. But doesn't matter how difficult it is. The matter is we have a vision and we have a goal. We want to achieve what is the nation needs.
That is the amazing courage of Shukriya Barakzai running for re-election as a member of parliament
in Afghanistan.
Her. Absolutely, sure. If I could. Quentin Somerville also joined us. He was reporting in Afghanistan for us and for our partner, the BBC.
And now the indie film I'm Still Here. It's open in New York, but there's buzz around the nation about it. It's supposed to be a documentary about actor Joaquin Phoenix's own personal implosion. I mean, you know he's kind of erratic and unpredictable, but he's an actor. And it turns out that this appearance with David Letterman.
Now, this Two Lovers, now, it's loosely based on a novel by Dostoevsky. Is that correct?
I don't know. I mean, I think
it might say that in the opening credits.
Does it say that? Yeah. I haven't seen the movie.
Haven't seen the film yet, yeah. What a surprise.
That sort of drawling, drooling performance was a performance, not a scandalous lapse. Newsday critic and Takeaway film reviewer Rafer Guzman saw the documentary I'm Still Here about Phoenix and is here to explain what seems to be a bit of chain yanking on the part of the director and the star of this movie. They were performing all along?
Yeah, it turns out they really were, although I think they wanted us to be. I think they wanted us to think that this whole thing was actually happening, that Joaquin Phoenix was indeed experiencing some sort of meltdown, but it turns out that it was all essentially scripted.
And the idea of I'm Still Here is here's a comeback, a redemption story for Joaquin Phoenix, or is it really about media manipulation?
Well, I mean, it's supposed to be about his meltdown. Now I think I'm not sure what we're supposed to think. I mean, I think what happened was these guys wanted to perpetrate a fiction, and they wanted us to all believe that this was really happening. It didn't work. The film got widely panned by most people, and now I think they're having to come clean and tell everyone that you know, in fact, this was all a hoax.
So is this an Andy Warhol kind of an art piece, or is this just legitimately a bit of Hollywood corruption?
I think that was part of the problem when the film came out. There had already been some buzz that this thing might not be real. I think by the time the movie came out, that seed had been planted, and people were a little suspicious. And part of the problem with most reviews I read, I mean, including myself, you weren't really sure what was being done here. Was this sort of a Borat satire? Was this a mockumentary like Spinal Tap? Was this kind of a performance art piece? And it seemed to be kind of none of the above. I also have to say, I think audiences don't really take kindly to being fooled. I think if they're in on the joke, that's one thing. But I think if they're the butt of the joke, I don't think they react well.
So what other public lapses could we do documentaries on, Rafer? I mean, could there
what other public lapses?
Crispin Glover. Lindsay Lohan could
be
like an HBO series.
Great for politicians. They could say it was just fake.
What if
Mel Gibson would be a good one.
Mel Gibson, that's fabulous. What if he's faking? What if Lindsay Lohan is faking? Wow.
If Mel Gibson's faking, that would be performance art.
So does this mean Walk the Line is a fake movie and Johnny Cash actually didn't exist?
No. And I think, as I think we all actually knew from the beginning, Joaquin Phoenix is going to be back in the movies. He's considering more movie roles. He's going to be back on Letterman. And, you know, maybe everything will return to normal. Who knows?
Rafer, you hated the movie, though, right?
I didn't hate the movie. I was just a little nonplussed.
All right.
I wasn't sure what was happening.
Rafer Guzman, Newsday film critic and Takeaway film contributor.
Good morning, Celeste Headley here with John Hockenberry, taking a look at headlines at 47 minutes after the hour. Five men in London have been arrested over a potential threat to Pope Benedict XVI. The Vatican says the Pope doesn't plan to change his schedule, though. Earlier, he spoke to British schoolteachers in London.
I wish to add a particular word of appreciation for those whose task it is to ensure that our schools provide a safe environment for children and young people.
Today is day two of his official visit to the UK. Schools, markets, and shops are closed in Karachi today after a founding member of the country's biggest liberal party was stabbed to death in London. Imran Farooq was a member of Pakistan's largest liberal party. London police are looking into the death.
heated debate at the European Union summit over France's recent crackdown on the illegal immigrant camps of its gypsy population. In recent weeks, French authorities have deported more than 1,000 as they dismantled the camps. And yesterday, French President Nicolas Sarkozy defended the deportation, saying Germany had planned to follow suit. He's called the camps havens of crime and squalor. But the office of German Chancellor Angela Merkel denied those claims this morning. Oprah Winfrey seems to have ended an old feud, or realized she knows a good thing when she sees it. Author Jonathan Franzen had his book picked, Freedom, for her book club. You'll remember a decade ago, Franzen snubbed Winfrey when she picked his novel, The Corrections, for her book club. He said he was embarrassed to be included in her schmaltzy lineup. Will he be invited on the show? We'll find out. Those are some of the stories we're following this morning.
Most of us know Philip Seymour Hoffman from his acting roles in Boogie Nights, Happiness, Doubt, and of course Capote, for which he earned an Oscar. But today we see Philip Seymour Hoffman in a totally new role, that of feature film director.
I told him I loved him. He was a great dad, and he woke up out of the coma.
Woke up?
After 3 months.
Oh, God.
And then he fell down and hit his head in the hallway, and then he died.
Oh.
The movie's called Jack Goes Boating, and it opens today. And the problem is, if you excerpt something from this film, it's really hard to get a flavor of what the film is all about. So let's actually talk to the two stars. Philip Seymour Hoffman joins us in the studio today, and also Amy Ryan, who co-stars as his love interest in Jack Goes Boating. Good morning, and thank you both for being here.
Thank you for having us.
The first question whenever someone's making their debut as a director, which is kind of inevitable, because every time they interview actors, they say, what I really want to do is direct, right? So, I mean, you always...
Actually, that's not the... It's actually... I think it's more the mythology, you know,
right.
That actually, but most actors
don't want to take it on.
No,
never
too much.
They'd rather just take
that.
Home the check.
No one wants
and...
to be responsible for the failure. You know what I mean?
They can blame it on the
director. Yeah, it's you know.
Right. Well, I mean that leads to the inevitable question of A, why would you take this on, and B, if so, why this film?
I think my brain wants to do this stuff. You know what I mean? I think since I was very soon into my acting career. When I had jobs, I started thinking about things in the overall story idea. I remember taking acting classes, and even in acting classes back then, I remember, you know, identifying with the acting teacher in a way that wasn't about an acting, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like wanting to get up and talk about acting to the students and stuff, you know
right.
what I mean? Like I always had this kind of quality, this teacher kind of thing in me. I guess.
Your mom's a teacher, too, right?
She was a teacher, she's a teacher.
Well, you know, Amy, let me ask you, in the terms of getting your scene, and this movie is so intimate, and I'm wondering if it complicated it that the guy that you were having these very subtle, intimate, quiet scenes with was then going to step out of the scene and go, no, let's try it from another angle and turn the lights up, and she's got, you know, let's get that hair out of her face.
Well, yes, this is the first time that I've been in bed with my director.
Literally.
Oh, well, come on. Really?
On screen. On screen.
Okay.
But, oh, Lord.
Headlines everywhere. Yeah. Amy Ryan.
Oh, the scandal for Sidney Lumet right now. Oh, no. But there is, you know, but the point is Phil was absolutely 100% in that scene with me, acting with all heart and all intimacy, and so it really was the two of us in there together. He didn't have to, you know what, actually, now that I think of it, sometimes when you yell cut, there's this long pause and you feel the director coming towards you, and it's almost like the teacher coming down the hall and you're a little nervous, what are you going to say? But here Phil was literally in bed with me, and he just leaned over and whispered some small adjustment that the crew didn't hear. It was still very private.
Well, I'm kind of intentionally not going through the whole storyline of the movie because this movie is so subtle. It's so much of it happens in silences.
Yeah.
And that would seem to me to be the hardest thing you could possibly choose to both star in and direct. I mean, your focus for this film had to have been laser focused. And then you have to step out and worry about somebody's costume or... That would seem to be the hardest thing you could do. Why not an action film? Why not Pirates of the Caribbean 6?
I'm so glad you said that. It's so great to hear you say it. No one said that, and that's true. There was something I was trying to figure out while shooting this that I knew I couldn't put my finger on, and I was having a hard time putting into words, you know, and that was going to take a kind of sharp focus, and it was going to take all the parts equaling into a whole that was going to work or not work at all. You know what I mean?
Absolutely.
And doubt would creep in, and I would just have to kind of keep thinking about it. But ultimately, I explored everything I could explore on any given day. So at the end of the day, I thought, okay.
Well, we're kind of making it sound really, really serious, and it's not. The film is actually very funny. And one of the things that struck me in the film was the really whimsical sometimes and lovely music. Let's take a listen to some of the music that was composed for the film. I noticed, and I don't know if somebody's asked you about this before, and very often this piano music is playing anytime that we're seeing just you on the screen, and it's really reminiscent of Vince Guaraldi's music for Charlie Brown. It's and the movie's almost as though Jack is Charlie Brown as an adult.
That's funny. That stuff that's original music,
right?
That was composed by Evan Lurie. There's a couple moments in the film where his music is some of my favorite stuff. You know, Jack's in the Waiting Room is one.
Exactly, that's the one I was thinking of.
There's something he does with the piano in that sequence. It's just so moving, you know. And thank God he came on board because he really helped us out.
And, you know, Amy, I mean, a lot of people know you from The Wire. Clearly, if anyone saw Gone Baby Gone, they're going to remember that performance as well. But this film was probably a risk, don't you think?
No, not at all.
Really? I mean, because it's so subtle and quiet and intimate, and people have to buy in.
I never for a moment thought, oh, I shouldn't do this next because people are expecting something from me. In fact, if they're expecting something from me, I'm going to do everything I can to go the other direction.
Yeah.
Phil, did you have any pressure to kind of sex it up, to call it Jack finally gets laid, or to put in some scenes with some car? I mean, really, to make it more marketable, did anyone pressure you to add stuff in or take stuff out?
Jessica Biel turned down my part, actually.
Oh, I know. That was a dark day. Actually, no. I thought the people involved that supported this film were and are and have been incredibly supportive. But they did this film without giving away anything. This film does go to a place like it's really emotionally charged and a bit crazy because the people are at such a point in their lives and things start to act out, and which I think is really amazing. Great choices by the writer. And I remember they wanted to calm that down a bit. So the thing is, like, no, the film has to go to a place where people are kind of going, I can't believe he's doing that, you know, because I think that's what happens in life when things get that bad. People start to act crazy, and that causes other people to do something. So that was it, but that was it. Other than that, no, I think, you know, they were on board for having us show these people as humanly as possible and having them look the way they should look and be the way they should be. They were pretty great.
And it ends up being a film that's completely self-contained. You could never make a sequel to this. Jack gets married.
It would be really silly. Jack trains for the triathlon. It was like totally svelte. You know what I mean? That's for all the people out there.
Yeah, that would not work. Yeah. But truly so enjoyable that even my Expendables Rambo-watching husband absolutely loved it. The movie is called Jack Goes Boating. It opens today, starring Philip Seymour Hoffman and Amy Ryan. This is Philip Seymour Hoffman's directorial debut as a feature film director. Congratulations.
Thank you very much.
And this is some of the beautiful music featured in that film. This is called Snow by Evan Lurie.
Got some good reviews, that film. You want to get more film out of The Takeaway, go to Movie Date, our podcast with Newsday critic Rafer Guzman and Takeaway producer Kristen Meinzer. Head over to thetakeaway.org/podcasts. I'm John Hockenberry.
And I'm Celeste Headlee. This is The Takeaway.
The measure of rich keeps moving from generation to generation.
At one point, it meant having a big house and lots of livestock and not having to get your hands dirty in the fields.
I wouldn't have to work hard
By the time we got to the 20th century, though, the bar had moved considerably.
So let's go upper deck with a couple of my good friends and run away with the rich and famous.
Tax brackets place a marker at $250,000. But is that the current meaning of rich?
How do you know when you're rich? And does that change the definition of poor?
If I were a rich man.
It's the takeaway.
All across America, this is The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Celeste Headlee from Public Radio International and WNYC.
Good morning. Happy Friday. It is September 17th. We're talking a lot about the definitions of rich and poor and whether your emotions change those definitions.
How do you feel? How rich do you feel, folks? Let's get a check of the morning top news stories. The number of Americans living below the poverty line. Check this out. Soared last year to a 43.5 million people. The Census Bureau says the new number amounts to 1 in 7 people and 1 in 5 children in the U.S. At the same time, the number of millionaires in the country continues to grow. The number of households with a net worth of $1 million or more grew 16% last year. Charlie Ward, are you there?
Yes, sir.
Rapid City, South Dakota, is that where you are?
That's correct.
You recently found and sold the largest gold nugget discovered in the United States in more than 100 years, right?
In the Black Hills, South Dakota.
Wow.
Last 120 years.
Nice. How big was it?
Oh, about the size of an avocado pit.
Does that make you feel rich?
No, not really. I still got to get up, put my boots on in the morning and either go dig for more gold or bang some nails to make a little few dollars, you know.
There's some wisdom from Charlie Ward, prospector and co-owner of Icebox Mining Company in Rapid City, South Dakota. He recently found and sold the largest undisputed gold nugget in the Black Hills in the last 120 years. How rich do you feel, folks?
So if you have to get up and go to work, then you're not rich?
I don't know. He just has a little wisdom there.
All right. On other news, Hurricane Carl is expected to bring a 15-foot storm surge when it makes landfall in southern Mexico today. In addition to flooding, the Category 3 storm has winds of 120 miles per hour, and forecasters are not ruling out further strengthening before it strikes land.
Afghans are getting ready to go to the polls this morning ahead of tomorrow's election. Taliban fighters are making good on their promise to disrupt the voting. Militants killed 2 more election workers in northern Afghanistan this morning, but Defense Secretary Robert Gates says security does appear to be adequate.
The Afghans have a capable and competent security plan for the elections. We will provide support as needed.
How do you define adequate, though? Our partner, the BBC, reports the death toll for campaign staff and election workers in the run-up to tomorrow's vote now stands at 24. Second round of recent peace talks between the Israelis and Palestinians have ended for now. Secretary of State Hillary Clinton says if an agreement is going to be reached, the conditions, she says, right now are all set.
I am convinced that this is the time and these are the leaders who can achieve the result we all seek.
Latest talks end as an Israeli soldier shot and killed a Hamas military commander in the West Bank this morning. Palestinian leaders condemned the killing, saying it could jeopardize the ongoing negotiations.
5 men in London have been arrested over a potential threat to Pope Benedict XVI. The Vatican says the Pope does not plan to change his schedule, though. Today is the second day of his first state visit to the UK in years. And the gay rights organization that won a ruling declaring military's Don't Ask, Don't Tell policy unconstitutional. They want that policy to stop being enforced immediately. That's according to a proposal filed by the Log Cabin Republicans to the judge. Looking at the markets, Asian and European markets are mixed. Futures are up. The Dow will start at 10,594, the S&P at 1,124, and the NASDAQ at 2,305. Well, all morning we're grappling with this idea. What does it mean to be rich? What does it mean to be poor? Do you feel rich or poor, and what makes you feel that way? Let us know.
Money.
877- I bet it's 8778.
Money. I'm guessing money.
Comfortable bed.
How rich do you feel, folks? Coming up.
Classic situation where you have a headline, just a stark fact, which is the new census numbers saying that the number of people who are below the poverty line in the United States now is nearing record levels, nearing levels we haven't seen since the 1960s.
15% below the poverty line. You also got this debate over whether 250,000 in personal income per year is rich. And,
right, and
that's what the
that's
tax
really
cuts
like only,
are all
what,
about.
2-3% of the population
that's
in the
right.
United States?
Right.
So you have here you have these statistics and these headlines, but what we're really getting at is a philosophical idea of rich or poor, wealth. What exactly does it mean? We had one listener, Alan from Rhode Island, who said, rich or poor is a state of mind. And we're wondering if that's true. So let me put that question to Larry Samuel. Larry is the author of Rich, The Rise and Fall of American Wealth Culture, and he's also been called the Margaret Mead of plutocrats by Slate Magazine. Good morning, Larry.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
I'm wondering if you buy this idea that there is a distinct difference between the political official definition of rich and poor and the state of mind that Alan in Rhode Island is talking about, the way that people feel.
Right. I think he makes a great point, because everything I've read and written about suggests that that rich is a state of mind, that because money is so relative and you're always comparing, you know, what you have to other people, that there's very little correlation between wealth and happiness. So that's where you start. I mean, does having money make you happy? And the research suggests not so much, and that's what I found as well.
Well, but that argues that really the definition of rich really does change over the centuries, that it's oftentimes a cultural concept. Going back to the Golden Age, our idea of the guy in the tuxedo and the cigarette and the cigarette holder, that's very different than our idea of rich today.
Yeah, but I think in our society, we put so much emphasis on money and materialism and consumption that rich has become much more associated with money, how many dollars you have in your bank account. So that's just, you know, the story of our time and place. And I think when historians do look back on the late 20th century, early 21st century, it's going to be about how much money there was, because this country had, until a couple of years ago, and I think will again, more money than any other people in any other society in history. So it's kind of remarkable if you look at it, you know, in terms of millennia. It's quite a story we have.
You know, and there are so many characters in American history who've had more money literally than God. I mean, they had more money than they could even keep track of. I mean, the Rockefellers, J.P. Morgan, yeah, et cetera. And you got Bill Gates today. You know, you hear this debate about people who are unwilling to be taxed if they make more than $250,000. You've heard the expression, if you ask the price, you must not be rich.
It's true.
So does that mean if people actually feel the sting of these taxes at above $250,000, they're probably not really rich?
I don't think they are. I think it's actually a really low number. Or I just wouldn't look at annual income as a basis. It's a very poor measure. I mean, you could make $250,000, but you could spend $300,000. So are you rich? No, you're in debt. I draw a distinction, first of all, between rich and wealthy. It's two completely different things. And we're so focused on rich that we've lost this idea of wealth culture, that there used to be an identifiable wealth culture in the United States that in which wealth cross hands, you know, over generations, and they subscribe to a certain set of codes that they don't really do anymore. You know, if you think about, you know, they dress a certain way, they spoke a certain way, they had these social signifiers of elitism. It's gone, basically. They're extinct. So it's become all about money, how many dollars you've had. In a way, I think we're kind of a poorer place, because then it just comes down to, you know, how much money you have versus someone else. And somebody always has more, so you're in trouble from the start.
Well, Larry, let me read you a comment from one of our listeners and get your response to it. Stacey Hill in Massachusetts writes this. She says, the best definition I read of what it means to be rich was on classmatters.org. It said, when you're rich, everything works, meaning you don't have to worry about whether your car runs, if the lights are going to be on, or what will happen if you break a tooth or if the computer crashes. When you're rich, you don't have to worry about the details of existing. Being poor means that even in the best of times, you're constantly struggling to keep those very things together. I'm wondering what your response is to that definition.
I like that. I like that. To me, I tweak it a little bit. To me, it's about time. Because if you think about it, we have two different resources in our society. You have money, because you need money to buy things and survive. But really, it comes down to time. So if you're rich, to me, you're spending the time the way you want to, your limited amount of time the way you want to. That, to me, is the ultimate form of wealth. And sometimes it's correlated with monetary wealth, and sometimes it isn't. There's a lot of poor people, I'm sure, that are living richer lives, so to speak, than people who are millionaires.
And yet that also argues that this Great Recession has really changed the idea of being rich. If it's true that being rich means things work, then during this period of time when people are unemployed, when they can't pay bills, when they're losing their homes, that means the definition of rich has changed.
It has, and I think it's been good and bad. I mean, we're focusing on the bad because it has made people struggle, and it's rough out there. But it also, I know a lot of people who are living richer lives than when they were working at their 9-to-5 job and then lost their job and were sort of forced into pursuing their passions, for better or worse, and they're happier. They're less wealthy in terms of money, but I'm finding them as happier people. So it's sort of ironic that the recession and now depression has made some people happier.
Do you think that the conversation over wealthy or rich is hampered by the sort of political definitions that are kind of slapped onto personal income?
Well, I think politics gets in the way of everything because it has to be so extreme these days. You know, it's so polarized. So I think, I think it gets in the way and is damaging to, you know, the real definitions, the stuff that really matters. Yeah, because it becomes agenda-based, which isn't really the point. It's really about, you know, can we live fulfilled lives? And then it becomes, you know, a chip in a political game, which gets in the way. Yeah.
So we have come out of a time when there was a great pursuit of richness. Would you say that's pretty accurate?
Absolutely. Yeah.
And so what time are we in now?
Well, we're in a low. We're in a setback, and it reminds me of a lot of what happened in the 30s and in the early 70s and to some extent in the early 80s and early 90s. And this is a natural thing. It's painful. But, you know, there's a boom and a bust, and we're in a bust. But in 5 to 7 years, we're going to be having a much different conversation because there's going to be a new bar to reach, you know, that superseded hedge funds, you know, which superseded .com and superseded all the other ways to get fabulously wealthy through the 20th century. We don't know what it is. I wish I knew what it was.
Learn Chinese.
that could be it.
Emmanuel in Mandarin from
Learn
Larry
Mandarin.
Samuel.
Yeah.
Larry Samuel's author of Rich, The Rise and Fall of American Wealth Culture. Thanks so much for joining us. And you can keep this conversation going. Tell us what signs make you feel rich and what makes you feel poor. Give us a call at 877-8-MY-TAKE. And now at 15 minutes past the hour, let's check in on other headlines.
Final preparations underway in Afghanistan for tomorrow's parliamentary elections. 300,000 Afghan soldiers and police, backed by about 150,000 foreign troops, have been mobilized. NATO Commander Nick Carter expects the Taliban to do all it can to disrupt the vote, like they did last time. Shukriya Barzakhzai is standing as a candidate. We spoke to her earlier on The Takeaway.
This is important for us right now to have a new parliament and again to practicing the exercise of democracy.
Shukriya Barzakhzai lost 2 children in the Afghan civil war. A record number of Afghan women are running for office this election. Record-breaking day in California. It's the 79th day that the state has been without a budget, the longest standoff yet.
And shareholders of Continental Airlines and United Airlines vote on a $3 billion deal between the two companies today. If it's approved, the merger would create the world's biggest airline. It would be known as United Airlines, but it would be run by Continental's current CEO. So they both get a little something out of the deal.
Oh, that's nice. Isn't that's that cute. Nice?
Comedy Central's Jon Stewart is appealing to all reasonable people fed up with crazy politicians to join him in a march on D.C.
See you October 30th on the National Mall. Spreading the timeless message. Take it down a notch. For America.
Not to be outdone, Stephen Colbert followed The Daily Show with his announcement of a complimentary rally of his own celebrating fear. That's a look at some of the stories that we're watching this morning. But we want to keep this conversation going this morning about what it feels like to be rich or poor. Do you feel rich? Do you feel poor right now? Give us some ideas and share us stories from your life. Weigh in at thetakeaway.org.
Or what would you call your own personal rally on the Washington Mall? Call it a heartbeat. Call it a clock ticking, saying time is running out for the way things have always been. Bob Dylan sang the times they are a-changing. Jimi Hendrix was the time warp itself. Jimi Hendrix died 40 years ago tomorrow, which means more than a generation has been asked the question,
so, are you experienced?
Has been stuck in Hendrix cosmic crosstown traffic. Heard the wind cry, Mary. a performer, innovator, and demon of the electric guitar, Hendrix stands with Paganini on the violin. Or Liszt on the piano. And someone who ripped the possibilities of music wide open. Not only did he kiss the sky, Jimi Hendrix made it bigger.
Let me prove it to you.
Hard to believe, 40 years ago. You know, I think Jimi Hendrix and Liszt and Paganini would have hung out together. So
well, Hendrix would have been one of the few people able to play Paganini's music
right.
on the guitar.
Exactly. Left-handed, too.
That's
today,
right.
Today we welcome to talk about this 40 years that have passed since Jimi Hendrix left us is Vernon Reid, founder of the hard rock band Living Color. Vernon Reid, thanks so much. Joining us from Hurricane Alley there in Staten Island, New York this morning, right?
Yep, no power. So this is... That was a fantastic introduction, and it's great to be on the show. I am a listener of the show. So.
Oh, thanks, Vernon. Well, what would you add to that legacy? I mean, you perform Hendrix covers all the time. I mean, you're really heavily influenced by Hendrix and carry on the tradition in many ways.
Well, Jimi Hendrix is a singular figure in American musical history and in world musical history. I mean, he was part of a tumultuous decade in the 60s, and He was influenced by a lot of different things. I mean, he was certainly influenced by the Texas blues men. He was influenced by T-Bone Walker. He was influenced by Albert King. He was influenced by all the R&B that he played. He was very influenced by Curtis Mayfield, if you listen to his rhythm guitar playing. He was very influenced by Curtis Mayfield. And, you know, he played with some of the seminal bands and figures of his day. He played with Little Richard in his band, and he also really notably played with the Isley Brothers. And the thing that's so funny about that is that the guitar had a particular role in R&B. It was, I mean, rhythm and blues at that time was really a showcase for singers and not for instrumentalists.
Right.
And
good point.
And he was under manners. He was really under manners, you know. And I think he had a real conflict with Little Richard. Richard was the star of the show, and here comes this flashy guitar player, you know, putting the guitar behind his head like T-Bone Walker, and it was like, that was not on. And eventually, Jimmy, he did something really remarkable. I mean, he was from Seattle, and he went on, you could say, a hero's quest, a hero's journey to find himself. I mean, it took him eventually to Harlem, it took him to the Greenwich Village, and it eventually took him to London. And it's kind of unprecedented. You've been mentioning the whole notion of migration amongst African Americans.
Right, right.
And he took a particular, a singular migration, which led to him becoming an international star on the one hand, but also one of the most influential musicians of all time, one of the most important American musicians, certainly of the 20th century.
Well, Vernon, you make a huge point about this kind of ethnic androgyny, a national androgyny of Jimi Hendrix coming from a weird place like Seattle, which, you know, back in the 60s, you know, barely registered, long before Bill Gates and Seattle even, you know, had this kind of identity that it has today. What was it about, and you're a guitar player, what was it about his playing that made it so huge? I mean, he played in small bands, but if Jimi Hendrix was playing guitar, it was like a giant orchestra.
Well, he was on the one hand, he was very shy, but on the other hand, he was clearly a very expressive person, and he was relentlessly present. I mean to say, he was a real, true improviser. He took all the influences that he had. I mean, including the songwriting influence of Bob Dylan and everything else, and he fused it with emerging technology. Because it's funny to think of a fuzz box or a wah-wah pedal or a phase shifter as technology, but that's exactly what they are. And they were cutting edge at the time. And he took full advantage of it. I mean, not only on the stage, but in the studio. So he did things in the studio with pitch shifting that really hadn't been done before, with layering guitars and things of that nature. But when he played live, he played at a really high volume. This is one of the famous things about him. But he played through these Marshall amps he played with a lot of different guitars, notably the Fender Stratocaster. And at that volume, the guitar takes on a completely different character. And you take that volume and you add to it something like a thing like a fuzz box, And then you get the guitar can become barely controllable. You get a lot of feedback. But he was able to take feedback and melody and meld them together and shape them and wield them together, which is, you know, so he had this kind of orgiastic, ergonomic thing morphing between melody and noise and back again. So he could go from a whisper to a scream, and he had complete control of it, which was freaky.
Freaky and completely unforgettable. It's the founder of Living Color, Vernon Reed, who also plays a lot of Hendrix on his own guitar, talking to us about Jimi Hendrix 40 years after he left us. You know, he makes this point about the fuzz box and the distortion.
Yeah, that's a really interesting way to listen.
It's like string playing. It's like bowed strings. The sustain is, you know, almost infinite.
Right, except what he was basically doing was taking what would be considered a squeak on the violin and exploiting it and turning that into part of the melody in the music.
Although, you know, the bowing on a violin is kind of a sustained sort of squeak where you're
taking
the...
To a certain extent. I'm just saying that he's taking what you'd think of as a mistake, you know, the feedback, and turning it
into
actually
an element. Yeah, it was very
intentional
on his part, that's
for sure.
Yeah,
an element to the music.
Hold a note forever. The Tea Party, beat 'em or join 'em. Who has to decide? Well, House Minority Whip Eric Cantor joins us for a Republican discussion of Tuesday's primary elections. That's in a moment. Right now, let's check top news stories at 30 minutes after the hour.
Elizabeth Warren says she has, quote, enthusiastically agreed to serve as an assistant to the president and special advisor to the Secretary of the Treasury on the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau. Warren posted her decision on the White House blog this morning. President Obama is expected to formally announce her appointment later this afternoon. Hurricane Carl is kicking up surf in the Gulf this morning as it gets close to land. Michael Brennan of the National Hurricane Center says Carl's taking aim at Mexico's southeastern coast.
Carl will be making landfall on the coast of Mexico late Friday, somewhere in the hurricane warning area, which goes from Veracruz to Cabo Rojo.
Meanwhile, residents in Bermuda are nervously awaiting Category 4 Hurricane Igor, which is on track for the island this weekend.
Five men in London have been arrested over a potential threat to Pope Benedict XVI. The Vatican says the Pope doesn't plan to change his schedule. It's the second day of his first state visit to the UK. Scientists have found evidence showing the disease that causes AIDS has been in monkeys for at least 32,000 years, and not just a few hundred, as people previously thought. And fans of We the People, listen up. Today is the 223rd birthday of the U.S. Constitution, ratified by the Constitutional Convention in Philadelphia on this day in 1787.
Should I sing the song?
Yeah. Happy birthday.
We the People
to you.
That's the wrong song.
Well, it's a birthday, though.
Oh.
Yeah. So, happy birthday to We the People. Happy birthday, We the People.
In order to form a perfect union.
223 years old.
Justice.
Checking the markets now, the Dow is, well, not exactly on fire, but it is up about 37 points in early trading. The S&P is up about 7 points, and the NASDAQ is up 15.9. Those are some of the stories we're watching this morning. So shifting gears to politics for a moment, we've been talking about the success of the Tea Party all week long here on the program. Somebody is going to have to embrace the sort of cactus, prickly Tea Party folks like Kevin Street from Delaware, who spoke on the program yesterday.
We've been trying to say to the GOP that most of our ideas are in line, but there are certain things that we're just not willing to compromise on.
Who's going to embrace the likes of Kevin Street in the GOP? Well, House Minority Whip Eric Cantor might be one of them. Republican Congressman from Virginia joins us now. Good morning, Congressman.
Hi, good morning. Good to be with you.
So how are you going to embrace the Tea Party and maintain the GOP establishment as you've understood it up till now?
What's uniting the Tea Party, uniting independents, Republicans, and Democrats across the country, John, is a frustration born out of the runaway spending in Washington. People are tired of it. They want Washington to stop spending money we don't have. And frankly, they want to rein in the government and get it out of so many aspects of our lives that it has no business in. And finally, get back to business. And I think people across the spectrum would like to see politicians do the things that they represent that they're going to do and stop making promises they can't keep.
All right, but they seem to also want to notch their belt with Republican incumbents, and so far I count they have maybe 6 or 7.
Well, that's true. The primary season is now over, as we saw the end of it in New York and Delaware and a couple of other states. The ire of the electorate did come out against individuals, many of whom were incumbents, who, that people felt didn't live up to those ideals of limited government and free enterprise and being true to their word on the campaign trail. I think that ire now will turn on the Democrats for sure. The Democrats are in charge and have been in pursuit of an agenda that probably can be deemed the most liberal agenda in generations.
But how's that ire turning on the Democrats going to benefit the GOP when a lot of very weak candidates, particularly in these Senate races, are going up against strong Democrats?
Well, I'm particularly focused on the House. And
that's a dodge.
And the House Republican candidates have seen an extraordinary lift in the polls over the last several months. And it's because I believe that our focus as House Republicans has been to return back to the common sense conservative principles that so much of this frustration is coming out longing for.
Are you worried that the president has nailed you with this $100,000 tax cut for millionaires label?
I think the age-old class warfare that this president and his team and the majority in Congress have been about is tired and just not working on the public. Right now, the public understands that small business people are the ones who create jobs. In fact, statistics indicate that over two-thirds of the jobs created in this country are from small business people. If you let taxes go up, you're going to disproportionately impact the very people you're counting on to create jobs. And people know that in their gut, they know that's what America's about. That's where the jobs are. It's not born out of more spending in Washington, which is what the White House, the President, Nancy Pelosi, Harry Reid continue to think.
Well, Eric, you know, there is a body of people who have a lower approval rate than the President, right? I mean, that's Congress. And part of the things that people are upset about is they feel that the Congress itself is disconnected from the issues they're struggling with. Do you think that the Republicans and Democrats can actually work together to find bipartisan solutions at some point?
I certainly hope so, and I do think that's the answer to our beginning to come out of this deep, deep recession that's affected so many millions of Americans. And my colleagues and I in the House have begun a program called The Young Guns, and we have just come out with a book. This is Kevin McCarthy, Paul Ryan, and I. And what it was, this group was sort of dubbed that Young Guns by Fred Barnes, who had written an article several years ago about what we were intending to do. And what we intend to do is say, look, we've learned from our mistakes in the past. The Republican Party, when it was in control, lost its way, particularly on spending. But now we have also seen and learned from the mistakes that the Pelosi majority and President Obama and his team have made, which is to put all of its stakes on growing Washington, spending taxpayer dollars,
right,
to try and jump the economy.
Well, Congressman Cantor, good luck with that book. I mean, some would say Fred Barnes, Eric Cantor, that's not the Young Guns, that's the old guard. Sarah Palin would be the young gun here. Does Sarah Palin complicate the GOP's mission here, or are you just thrilled with what she's been doing?
Well, Sarah Palin brings an extraordinary force of intensity to the table. There are millions of Americans who look up to her. I mean,
are you one of them?
She is absolutely. She is a leader in her own right. She is a role model for many in this country.
For you?
Because people feel that, you know, if you look at Sarah Palin, she's a working mom. She's testament to the fact that in America, not only can you have everything, you can do everything. You know, and so this villainization of Sarah Palin really has no place in the discourse. And I think that goes right to the point here of why I'm cautiously optimistic, but strongly so, that Republicans in the House are going to do so well in November.
All right,
because people are tired of the old politics of villainization, of attacks, and they want to see ideas come to the table based on the common sense conservative principles of less taxes, of free enterprise, and they want government out of deciding who wins and loses.
Well, I can hear the caution, but we will definitely find out where all those issues will play in November. House Minority Whip Eric Cantor, thanks so much for being on the program.
So you heard the discussion with Eric Cantor talking about people sliding a little bit further to the right, maybe on the Republican political scale. And we're wondering whether people really have been finding themselves moving along the political spectrum. And we asked you.
This is Kirsten from Florida. I'm moving more towards libertarian.
I've definitely moved to the middle.
I'm joining the Tea Party.
I'm definitely moving very, very far to the left.
I'm not leaning either way. Both parties, they both disgust me.
Margaret from Staten Island posts on our site, I don't agree with many of the Tea Party messages, but I have to applaud the commitment to saying enough is enough.
Who's going to be able to electorally take advantage of that angst? That's really the puzzle here.
Yeah, but it's going to be an interesting watch. Here's another response.
My name's Dane. I'm from Oklahoma. I noticed lately I've been moving further to the right as far as financial issues and government issues go, but definitely been moving to the left as far as social issues go. I'm starting to care a lot less about abortion and whatnot, but I'm really, really concerned about the economy.
Could be a political emblem right there in what Dane was saying.
Dane
from
Oklahoma.
Oklahoma.
I actually hear a lot of people talking about fiscal conservatism and social liberalism. But we want you to keep this conversation going. Let us know where you are on the political spectrum. Head over to the takeaway.org/elections. Takeaway, neither right nor left, right in the middle.
So we're talking about 40 years without Jimi Hendrix, and boy, we sure can't get enough of Vernon Reid, founder of Living Color and other bands, talking about what these 40 years and what the legacy of Jimi Hendrix actually has been. Vernon, you know, I just love how you've taken us in so many different directions, and of course, you just make me want to listen to more music. Would he be a social critic today in the way he was in the 60s?
Well, absolutely he would be, because the thing about Jimi Hendrix is that he, when you played a bit of Machine Gun.
Well, let's hear it. Let's hear Machine Gun. We'll listen to a Machine Gun, and Vernon Reid will be back with us in a moment. Vernon, continue that thought. Hendrix as a social critic. What were you going to say?
Well, I think Jimmy had a real conflict in that he, on the one hand, was very identified with the movements of the 60s, and at the same time, he was somewhat ambivalent about them. He was, on one hand, you know, he was a veteran. You know, he was a paratrooper.
Right.
His father
right.
was a veteran. But he also saw that the Vietnam War was unjust. He was someone, on the one hand, that America rejected. He had to go to London to get recognition. But he had a yearning for connection with American brethren, and that was part of the thing that really was behind his social criticism. When he played Machine Gun with the Band of Gypsies, the fact that the Band of Gypsies was an all African American band was a kind of statement in and of itself.
Sure.
After having you know, Mitch Mitchell and Noel Redding as his band, you can hear. You know, there's a line in the song, evil men make me kill you, evil men make you kill me, even though we're only families apart.
And that's one of the reasons why Hendrix's music went back across the Pacific and was played by soldiers in Vietnam as part of their own protest. You can hear Hendrix being played in Apocalypse Now.
You know, Jimi Hendrix really taught the United States about existentialism to a certain extent. I mean, that's what that music for me is an expression of. And he talked actually a lot about the political tone of his music and the fact that he felt, in fact, at one point he said politics is all about ego and music is the one thing that can transcend words.
Well, we certainly want to thank Vernon Reid for being on the program this morning, founder of Living Color. Vernon Reid talking about the legacy of Jimi Hendrix 40 years after he left us. I think my favorite lyric is Castles Made of Sand. And so castles made of sand eventually, you know, fall into the sea. Castles made of sand fall into the sea eventually. I can even hear him saying that. Sort of everything is impermanent.
My favorite is Little Wing. I can listen to that song pretty much endlessly all day. It's a beautiful, I mean,
great
lots of people
song.
Have redone it. Hendrix tune, best Hendrix riff, best Hendrix cover. You know how to reach us, 877-8-MY-TAKE. It's been 40 years since Jimi Hendrix passed. What do you think? Good morning. Celeste Headlee here with John Hockenberry. Let's look at headlines now at 47 minutes after the hour. Thousands of Afghan and NATO troops are being deployed across Afghanistan ahead of tomorrow's election. Haroon Mir, director of the Afghanistan Center for Research and Policy Studies, says fraud is a big concern.
We are not very much confident that this could be a successful process, because what happened last year was a big, big problem which undermined democracy in Afghanistan.
Our partner, the BBC, says 18 election officials have been kidnapped today by the Taliban. Schools, markets and shops are closed in Karachi today after a founding member of the country's biggest liberal party was stabbed to death in London. Pakistani media reports say vehicles were burned and shots were fired in Karachi when the news broke. Imran Farooq was a member of the coalition government. London police are looking into the death.
Nine trucks carrying 203 tons of rice have crossed from South Korea into North Korea today, the first relief donation South Korea has sent to its northern neighbor in nearly 3 years. Johnson & Johnson says it is in advanced talks to acquire Dutch biotech firm Crucell NV. The deal is valued at more than $2 billion. It would give a big boost to the American company's vaccine business. And a parrot in the Colombian city of Barranquilla has been arrested in a police drug raid. A police spokesman told reporters that Lorenzo the parrot had been trained to say, "Run, run, you're going to get caught," in Spanish. The parrot is just one of nearly 1,700 trained lookout birds seized by Colombian law enforcement.
It's sad when young fowl go bad.
Yes, indeed.
And run afoul of the law.
Yes, indeed. Those are some of the stories we're following this morning. Fowl stories. All of them.
Catherine Schwarzenegger joins us now, part Kennedy, part Hollywood royalty, as we discussed before. But she actually has some things to talk about in terms of her background that have nothing to do with her famous parents. She wants to remind people that not very long ago, she was a young girl that faced the same exact pressures that teenage girls everywhere in America face. And she's learned some lessons from those experiences that she wants to share. She's written a new book about them. It's called Rock What You've Got, Secrets to Loving Your Inner and Outer Beauty from Someone Who's Been There and Back. Good morning. Thanks for joining
us. Good morning. Thank you.
Well, we often get looks at the children of famous people, right? I mean, do you watch other children of famous people going on to interview shows or writing books or becoming actors and all those other things and think, I want to do that, or maybe I don't want to do that?
No, I mean, I didn't think that this would turn into a book. I think that it just started as a initial interest in the whole topic of body image. But, you know, I just kind of ran with what I was passionate about, and it became a book.
You were passionate about body image because you yourself felt like you'd had troubles with it in your high school experience.
Yeah. I mean, I think that I was like most girls and just felt insecure about my body in high school and went through all the changes that normal girls go through. And I think I saw a lot of younger girls and dealing with the pressures that the media put on them to look perfect and that to look like a size zero or a size two, and how much they struggle with that. So I wanted to write this book to let girls know that they're not alone when they're going through all of these doubts about their body and these insecurities and all that.
You know, your dad is Arnold Schwarzenegger. Right? I mean, you know this.
Yeah.
He could probably train.
I'm aware.
Could probably take you to the gym.
Yeah.
Bodybuilder.
Well, you know, When they gave me this book to read, I thought, I am not the target audience for this book, mm-hmm. right? I mean, what's the age you're looking at for?
I mean, it's really, it was originally directed for tweens, but it has a lot in there that's for moms only, as you can probably
see. But teenage girls?
Yeah, teenage girls.
Who are struggling through high school.
Exactly. And
all right. So we have a live teenage girl here who read the book and has a couple questions for you. She's my stepdaughter, Amber Sandora, who is getting out of French class to talk to you today. Good morning, Amber.
Hi. Good morning.
Amber Sandora, meet Catherine Schwarzenegger.
Hi.
Hi, Catherine.
And Amber, you had a couple questions.
Yes, I did.
Go ahead.
I was wondering, your dad is Arnold Schwarzenegger and your mom is Maria Shriver. With your background, how can you really understand what it's like for us regular teenage girls?
I actually got that question before, but I think that, you know, just because I come from a different background and I have famous parents, it doesn't mean that I wasn't like a normal girl in high school and didn't go through the same insecurities and doubts about my body that every other girl in the world goes through. I think that just because I had parents that are well known that didn't shield me from having these doubts about my body and these insecurities. And, you know, my body was changing in high school just like every other girl's body, and having well-known parents doesn't really stop that. And so I think that I can really relate to every other girl who is going through these changes and who has, you know, doubts about their body, insecurities, questions, and doesn't really feel secure in her new body. And I think that's really where I can relate to all of you guys. And, you know, I'm just like you guys and go through the exact same changes.
Amber?
Mm-hmm. And growing up in Los Angeles, surrounded by all the celebrities, did you feel pressured to look more of a certain way or conform to certain ideas?
I think definitely growing up in Los Angeles, you see a lot more of, you know, the celebrity looks, and you get a lot more pressure. But I think that, you know, my family did a really good job of keeping me and my siblings out of the public eye. So there wasn't extra pressure for us because we were, you know, children of famous parents. But I think definitely living in, you know, bigger cities like that, you feel more pressure, but definitely had nothing to do with my parents being famous.
Amber, can I ask you something?
Sure.
Do you get doubts about your own appearance?
Not normally. I have very good self-conscience, and I have great parents who help me with, you know, having questions and just letting me know how I look and that I'm good the way that I am.
Is it helpful for you, though, to hear somebody like Katherine Schwarzenegger and think, look, she has insecurities just like I do? Or do you feel like she's removed?
No, I feel that, I mean, everybody feels them, and I think it's, I mean, not great, but I mean, it's good to know that you're not the only one, and that everybody, no matter who they are, feels the insecurities.
Katherine, you know, you've talked about how you're like everyone else. It's also true that you carry this legacy. I mean, you're the next generation of the Kennedy women. Mm-hmm. And we've been talking on the show what it means to be rich, what it means to feel rich. What do you feel in terms of your responsibility to carry on this legacy? I mean, Eunice Shriver, your grandmother, right?
Yeah.
Right? Her tradition of public service is like a legend throughout the world. And your mom, of course, a fabulous journalist, and with her own sense of what the need is to give back. What's your turn now?
I think that I grew up with a very with a very strict line of the fact that community service is really important in everyone's life. And so I definitely grew up with a lot of emphasis on giving back to your community and how important that is. So I think that I definitely have that responsibility of making sure to always give back to my community and to help others who are in need. So I definitely grew up with that in my life. But I think everything else, I don't think there's a lot of pressure. I think people think there's a lot of pressure of us to go into politics and do something really great and, you know, everything like that. But I think that our family was really good on always making sure that we could be who we are and not feel that we have to be something that we're not just because our family has done something else, you know. And I think that, you know, obviously community service is really big. Giving back to community, helping others who are in need is really a big deal. But other than that, I think that, you know, for all of us who are the next generation, it's just kind of a be who you are.
You know, Katherine, I got to ask you, you know, your book comes out at the same time that we're beginning to see a lot of Bristol Palin, and there's been kind of just talks kind of comparing the two of you. And to me, it seems like these are two very different people. In your book, you're extremely candid about going on the pill as a teenager. Is that right?
Mm-hmm. Yes.
And obviously, Bristol Palin is a very vocal about pro-abstinence leanings. I'm wondering if you feel caught up in your views politically.
No.
You don't at all?
No, not at all.
You don't buy into you're the anti-Bristol?
No.
Okay, well, that goes there. Go to that blog.
No. I think, you know, I think I see everything Bristol's doing, and I think that she seems like a great girl. I don't know her personally, but, you know, I admire everything that she's doing, and she's doing, I think, the best that she can do.
Okay, well, the book is aimed at people like Amber Sandora, who we just heard, 15-year-old high school sophomore. Amber, you're getting back to French class now, right?
Yeah.
Good, and you know, full disclosure, she is my stepdaughter. So thank you so much for joining us, Amber. Get to class. Also, Katherine Schwarzenegger, thanks for being here as well. Her new book is called Rock What You've Got, Secrets to Loving Your Inner and Outer Beauty from Someone Who's Been There and Back.
Who's also grappling with the burdens of public service, being a Kennedy girl in the third generation there, right? Yeah. Stuff. She's about, must be about 9 feet
tall. Third generation. Right? Yeah, she's like 12 feet tall.
So we head into the weekend. We're already planning out the news and issues we'll be covering next week. Get a sneak peek by heading to your blog at thetakeaway.org, where I, Celeste, producers, blog about the stories that we are following. And you can also get into the conversation early. Text the word START to 69866, and we'll tell you what we're working on. Give you a chance to be in on the conversation. I'm John Hockenberry.
And I'm Celeste Headley. This is The Takeaway.
At Radiolab, we love nothing more than nerding out about science, neuroscience, chemistry.
But we do also like to get into other kinds of stories. Stories about policing or
politics,
country music,
hockey,
sex of bugs.
Regardless of whether we're looking at science or not science, we bring a rigorous curiosity to get you the answers.
And hopefully make you see the world anew.
Radiolab, adventures on the edge of what we think we know.
Wherever you get your podcasts.